Welcome to Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz. Happy Friday, everyone. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your continuing commitment to give common sense a comeback. Busy show today. My voice is better, by the way. On the subscriber episode on Wednesday, I told you guys I was like on the cusp of losing my voice. I don't know what was going on, if it was a smoke or something. And then the next day I woke up and it was just fine again. So to those who hope to silence me next time, better luck next time. Undivided is presented by our founding sponsor, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com. And if you have not become a subscriber already, I am going to harass you until you do. You can become a subscriber for as little as $5 a month on Patreon or Locals, patreon.com/undivided or brandycruz.locals.com. Not only do you get the bonus episode on Wednesday, but you can also do monthly subscriber Q&As where we have a bunch of fun and people ask me questions about politics and all sorts of things. We do one every single month at the end of each month. We're actually going to start with Fridays with Friends today because I told you guys I was going to try to get our friend Jonathan Cho on to talk about what happened to him on Monday. I've ranted about it a little bit this week, but in case you haven't seen it, so first, just back up even a little further than that. You'll recall that Jonathan Cho tried to ask questions about public safety at a press conference with King County Executive Dow Constantine, and Dow Constantine ended up fleeing and trying to go down an elevator to avoid answering questions. And it's the executive's office's contention that Jonathan Cho is not a journalist because he's a fellow for the Discovery Institute, which has a political bend. But Jonathan Cho has been doing great independent journalism on homelessness. And he's been a journalist in Seattle for several years. And so I happen to think it's all just bullshit. But here's a little clip of what happened a few weeks ago.
So why not put a moratorium on this before public input?
You're not actually a journalist. You were fired for promoting the Proud Boys. So we talked with reporters like those in the room, and we're not.
So you're not talking to me anymore and accuse me of promoting the Proud Boys. You're an elected official.
And things have only ramped up since then. So on Monday, there was a press tour of this homelessness complex shelter in SoDo, the south of downtown Seattle. And it was invite only or RSVP for the media, but Jonathan Cho has been cut off from the executive's office, deemed not media, so he just showed up, and this is what ensued.
On the invite list, 24 hours.
It's open to members of the media.
I've contacted you multiple times, Marta. You haven't returned any of my calls.
Katie Rogers with King County, and you haven't given her 24 hours notice. So
you don't need to make a scene about that.
So are you going to? You haven't even sent me an email.
You're not a member of the media, Jonathan.
I'm not a member of the media, so I'm not
correct.
Being allowed to go into this tour?
Into the media tour? No, you're not.
Okay. What is it going to take for me to be able to go into this media tour?
You would have to work for a media organization, which you do not. You work for an advocacy group.
I work for Discovery Institute.
Which is an advocacy group.
Well, we have a media wing called fixhomelessness.org.
It's not a media wing.
Okay.
These are broadcast journalists, independent journalists. They work for media groups, not... Jonathan, you are not allowed in there.
I'm going to go as close. I don't understand why I'm not being allowed
because
to go in.
You're not a member of the media, Jonathan.
So I'm not being allowed to go in?
Nope.
No. Okay.
So I hopped on a Facebook Live on Monday and shared my just deep disappointment, my disgust with how he was treated. And I also don't understand to what end this is happening. I mean, what's the worst thing that happens if you let him in and he does a story on it? You don't like the outcome of the story? I just don't understand from a PR perspective what the executive's office thinks it's accomplishing here. But I also think it's incredibly dangerous to journalism. What would happen if some Republican politician wanted to keep out the Seattle's alt-weekly newspaper, The Stranger, because they, you know, disagree with them politically? And so I've, you know, not only am I disappointed deeply in the executive's office, but also with any members of the media who are staying silent on this. You know, I've received a few private messages from members of the press who are also concerned, but they won't say anything publicly. And I have stopped responding because I'm sorry, you know, at some point you have to speak out. I don't want anybody to lose their job or to be put in a difficult position, but the mainstream outlets need to be saying something. But anyway, I had Jonathan Cho join us. I wanted Jonathan Cho to join us today for Fridays with Friends to talk a little bit about what happened and I guess what his strategy is moving forward, because I can tell you one thing, he is not going to give up. Jonathan Cho, welcome back to Fridays with Friends. I wish it was for better reasons.
Yeah, I'm always here if there's a controversy, Brandy. So I'm used to this, part of the course. So
I know, I feel bad. Fridays with Friends is supposed to be fun, and then I'm always dragging people down. But you seem to be kind of taking this in stride. What were your expectations, I guess, when you went down there, knowing, you know, how your previous encounter with his office had gone, knowing that they'd kind of cut off communication with you? So what did you expect, I guess, when you showed up?
Well, since I'm part of the media and I'm a journalist, it was a press conference, and it was a tour of Dow Constantine's proposed homeless megaplex that's officially in SoTo, but a block away from the Chinatown ID. As this was happening, hundreds of senior citizens from Chinatown were marching towards this megaplex, and there was a group of journalists ready to go in. And because I was allowed into the last press conference, the last two prior to this, I thought it wouldn't be a problem. But as you know, according to the video, that's when this encounter ensued.
And, you know, I've been in touch with Dow's office, and they did say in this instance it had to be RSVP because of limited space in the actual area where people are living. But your contention is that even if you had, you're not getting the press releases, right?
Yeah, and that's the piece that Chase Gallagher, Dow Constantine's media handler, failed to mention. And it's, I'm not getting these emails anymore from them intentionally. They've cut me off. When I worked at Como, I was getting all of these press releases to come cover this event, that event. But now I don't get these anymore. So I wasn't even given an opportunity to RSVP. And that's why I showed up thinking, again, because they let me in the other press conferences up to this point, I wouldn't have any problems.
Yeah. And so it's disingenuous for them to say, oh, well, you had to RSVP 24 hours ago when they are clearly blocking your ability to RSVP. And I don't think the outcome would have been different had you somehow gotten that email and RSVP'd. I think they would have told you, we declined to participate in your project, as they've been telling you over and over. One other thing I want you to respond to in my conversations with the executive's office is they're taking issue with your sort of demeanor at some of these events. This is a place where people are living. They said there's an expectation of privacy, which to me suggested that they thought that you'd go into these bays where people are living and sleeping and kind of plaster their faces all over the place. So do you want to respond to the characterization that you are not on your best behavior at some of these events?
Well, first of all, thank you for bringing that to my attention. This is the first time I'm hearing anything of this. Dow Constantine, his handlers, they've never ever communicated any concerns they've had with me. Look, at the end of the day, I believe in common sense, decency, respect, and maintaining some form of decorum. And up to this point, it's been that way at the press conferences. I have absolutely zero idea where they're getting any sense that I would go and disrupt anyone's place of living, where they're sleeping. If they told me straight up, don't shoot video in this part of the shelter, I wouldn't do it. If they told me don't show this person's face, of course I wouldn't do it. I'm there as a guest, so I would never do anything that would, you know, cross any boundaries or rules if they had clearly laid that out. But once again, I was never given that opportunity to even go in and show this common decency.
Yeah, and one of the things I pointed out to them at the first press conference where, you know, we had this conversation because Dow ran away from you and went down, tried to go down an elevator. And I'll just, let me just play this clip quick.
Detective Constantine, I have a couple of questions related to public safety.
Yes.
So basically,
I'm sorry, we'll take any other questions offline.
We can
thank you very much.
Follow up with you.
So what people will notice is when you start to ask a question of Dow, you're very calm and professional. You ask a question, you want to ask a question about public safety, and it's not until they make it clear that they're not taking your questions that you sort of, you pursue him into the hallway. And something I said on the podcast the other day is, how would any reporter respond or journalist respond if they're being treated or met by that level of, pushback?
Yeah, despite the narrative, look, as you've interacted with me as well, Brandy, we've been out in the field together as well. I always try to respect officials, people who are in power, and especially if I'm, on their property or operating on their terms. Again, it's when they refuse to answer my questions or walk away, I feel like I have a right to, at the very least, ask and make sure that they heard my question. So again, a public official like Dow Constantine in a public place, again, according to my basic journalism one-on-one standards that I've always followed, they're fair game. I would never go after Dow Constantine if he's hanging out with his family or at his home. That's just not my style. But if he's in a public place, he's a public elected official on a government property, you know, that's open to the public. Again, I have every right to be there. He has every right to be there as well. And if he wants to answer my questions, great. If he doesn't, fine. So be it. But again, I plan on asking questions like this all the time in those contexts.
One more thing specific to this incident, and then I have a few more broad questions for you. You know, when you were trying to then, you know, record outside the gate looking in, there was an individual with an umbrella who was using it to block your view. I have not been able to ascertain who that person is, but it does not sound like it was an official with the executive's office, correct?
Yeah, look, it's hard to say. When I was out there, they had clearly at that point blocked me from going inside. So I stayed outside of the gated area. That's an area that's run by the Salvation Army shelter, and the Salvation Army's handlers and staff were also there, including their security. So, you know, it could have been anybody, but at the time, I was just kind of thinking out loud. And when I immediately saw that umbrella pop out from behind the fence, I was on the other side of the fence, according to the video, and I was just trying to record through the holes in the fence. An umbrella goes up, and immediately I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this is what Antifa did to me when I was covering the Black Lives Matter, you know, protests a couple years ago, when Antifa hijacked that movement. And I just couldn't believe what was happening. And again, at the moment, I was like, I cannot believe this. I'm at this event being held by Dow Constantine's people, you know, and I'm being blocked by somebody, some staff member on site. So I have yet to determine who that person was, but it wasn't just once, but multiple times, the umbrella coming out, trying to block my camera from simply recording.
Well, and that's what's important to note is this isn't just anybody, because they were inside a perimeter that was clearly being controlled for this particular event. So whether they're with the Salvation Army or a volunteer or something, they were someone who was actively allowed to be inside. What is your plan? I mean, are you going to continue to show up for Dow Constantine press events and push the issue, see what happens? What?
Yeah, short answer is yes, absolutely, especially if it's a press conference, if it's in a public place, if it's in a government building, absolutely I'm going to show up. And of course, I'm working back channels right now. I'm going to be emailing the executive's office and saying, what can we do to work this out? This is absolutely nuts, okay? Bottom line, I'm a journalist. I don't think Dow Constantine or his handlers get to determine who's a journalist, who's not, who gets to cover a particular story or tell it a certain way or not. I've been an objective journalist for more than 20 years of my career. I've now gone down this road where essentially I'm being backed by a think tank, but we have a media arm, and I've been covering all the stories fairly accurately and objectively up to this point. Bottom line, if you don't like my work, then just say it, but don't say I'm not a journalist. That's just not fair. So I'm at this point right now, and this is the positive news. And you know, to all of this, several news outlets have reached out to me to offer me media credentials, because they believe the work I'm doing is journalism. They still believe I'm a journalist. So I'm considering all of my options right now. But best case scenario, Brandy, is that the executive's office understands, hey, I'm a journalist. This is water under the bridge. This is nothing personal. Let's just get back to business. Bottom line, let's get this important information out to the community, out to the public. Because at the end of the day, when I can't ask these questions, you know, there's no assurances other reporters who are let in will ask the same questions I wanted to ask, that essentially are an extension of the community, especially the Chinatown ID community that is protesting against this megaplex. But if I can't get in these questions, we can't get out this information. Ultimately, it hurts democracy.
And that's one of the other things I told the executive's office is, have you actually watched what he's put out? Because by any standard, it's journalistic. I mean, very in-depth videos, really interesting content. So I just think, you know, if you apply no bias to it at all, it's journalism by any standard. And without going into too many details, you mentioned that some organizations have offered you press credentials. You and I have had that conversation as well, if it's helpful to get you to continue to go to these events. But I should note, none of those were mainstream outlets, correct? None of those were quote unquote mainstream outlets in Seattle who have stood up for you. Have you heard from any mainstream outlets in Seattle who have come to your defense?
Yeah, without naming any of the mainstream outlets, but I think your viewers and listeners are sophisticated enough to know who the mainstream players are. None of them have reached out whatsoever. It's been radio silence. And it is what it is. It's fine. Our entire
industry...
No, it's not fine.
It is the furthest thing from fine. So that's very generous of you, but to me, it's egregious.
Yeah, I mean, it's disappointing, honestly. It'd be nice to have a stronger fraternity, but clearly after incidents like this, it seems like every man and woman an outlet for themselves. And that's where we have issues right now in local Seattle media. I've said this numerous times now, but the politicians have robust PR teams, and they've clearly now outgunned local media, local Seattle media that's supposed to be there to hold these public officials accountable. And right now, it's just not happening. But I'm going to do my best to continue to at least play my part, Brandy.
Well, and also, I just wonder, what's the worst case scenario for them? So you ask a couple hard questions and they have to answer them, and then everybody moves on with their lives. I don't get why they think that they're coming across as the good guy in this. That's what's sort of baffling to me from a public relations standpoint. Two more things. Devil's advocate. Where do you think the line, because it can't be a free-for-all at a press event. Where do you think the line should be drawn between who's allowed to a press event and who's not allowed to a press event?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. That's a question that my team at Discovery Institute, we're debating as well. I've also reached out to a lot of my industry colleagues. Look, bottom line, I don't have a quick answer to that right now. And I think it's going to, you know, come down to a case-by-case basis. But in my instance and in my case, I'm a 20 plus year veteran. I have the pedigree. I have the resume. I've been doing this my entire career. I'm not just some fly by, you know, night operation that just popped up out of nowhere. And the institute I'm with, they've done solid work, including journalism there. So, you know, this is a very interesting time where our entire industry is fragmented. They're trying to redefine its identity as well. So look, I consider myself a journalist. So I say, look at the work I'm putting out. As you said, is it fair? Is it accurate? Is it objective? And does this person or outlet have a track record in the city? And I do. And I think that should be enough to be allowed in to cover this community and our politicians and the city of Seattle and this region.
Yeah, and I would argue it doesn't even have to be objective. I think yours is, but for instance, The Stranger covers press conferences. They're not objective. I don't have an issue with, I mean, I give my opinion. I think I should be allowed in. So I don't have an issue with that. I think the standard for me should be, are they producing content that people are, journalistic content that people are consuming? And it's not as if you're just showing up and then just to yell questions at them and then you're not putting anything out there.
Yeah, and look, I want everyone in Seattle, especially my followers and public officials, to know I have an audience. You know, I have a pretty big audience now, especially on social media. And the outpouring of support and people saying, oh, my gosh, you know, I'm getting all the news from you. I'm not watching mainstream local media anymore because they're not covering the stories like the homeless crisis or the crime or everything else that comes with it. I didn't know about the Chinatown story until you started covering it. And that makes me feel like I'm going down the right road and I'm headed in the right direction. I'm just hoping that these politicians, elected officials know I have an audience. People are following my work and I'm just going to keep on doing what I'm doing, Brandy.
Let's end with this. Are you worried about where this could go? My thought was when I look at the two instances that we've discussed with Dow Constantine's office, the first one was ridiculous, but the second one was a new level to me. You know, five people blocking your entry. And I kept thinking to myself, what would they have done to him if he had tried to kind of push his way in? Are you worried about what their next phase, their next step is going to be to try to keep you out?
Yeah, you know, it's going to be interesting. I'm bottom line, I'm going to test it, of course, and we'll see. So stay tuned for that. But my concern overall is this chilling effect that I believe it could have on journalism and journalists. Look, I'm going to tell you right now, there are several journalists reached out to me. They wanted to remain off the record and said, you know, Cho, this is why we can't do what you do. We can't ask the tough questions because we don't want to lose access. We don't want Dow Constantine's people or another elected official contacting our bosses, you know, and making a big deal. I mean, you have a lot of journalists who just want to keep their jobs. They just want to do what they're doing. So they don't want to tackle these tough subjects. But again, this is hurting our democracy when we can't get these questions asked or we can't get these answers and we can't hold our public officials accountable. So I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. But again, getting back to this concern about, you know, how we handle this moving forward. My concern is if public officials see this and they realize, hey, Dow Constantine's office can do this to Jonathan Cho, well, we can do it to other journalists we don't like. We're going to do this to other news outlets that we think, you know, don't align with our values or our agenda. So again, the chilling effect angle, let's wait and see what happens. But again, I still feel like there's time to correct course and for other public officials and other agencies to say, hey, look, look at the person's track record, look at the experience and look at the work at the end of the day and make that determination after you go through that process.
Yeah, well, those journalists, I understand they want to keep their job, but they stay silent at their own peril. And I have stopped responding to people who send me messages in solidarity privately, but won't say jack shit publicly. And that's my language, not yours, because I think at some point you have to be brave, or why are we doing this job to begin with? So Jonathan Cho, keep being brave. I don't know what they're going to do next. Are you willing to get arrested if it comes down to it?
Yeah, well, in Seattle, I don't think they would, because they don't even arrest the actual criminals. So we'll see what happens. But I don't think I'd push it that far. Again, I want to say for the record, I never tried to trespass on property. If they stopped me right there, I didn't go any further. So, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. If they have to remove me, then they have to remove me. But I hope they don't arrest me.
I'll bail you out, okay?
Thanks, Brandy. I know you will.
Jonathan Cho, where can people watch your work?
Mainly at fixhomelessness.org. That's our website for our stories. But a lot of the engagement and action happens on my Twitter site, at Cho Show, C-H-O-E-S-H-O-W.
Cool. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brandy.
I'll reiterate also what I said on the Facebook Live on Monday that I did on the subscriber-only episode on Wednesday. I do think it's helpful for those of you who are listening and watching. If there's a mainstream outlet in Seattle or Washington State that you consume, be it TV or print, reach out to them. Send an email. Make it polite, but make it firm that you think that they ought to be speaking out against this because you think it's a slippery slope, if you feel that way. I think that's very helpful. I mean, you know, mainstream cares about two things, money and ratings. And if they feel like either of those things are at risk, maybe they'll speak out and do something, or maybe they'll speak out because it's the right thing. I mean, that's certainly what I hope. So we'll stay tuned to what happens with Jonathan Cho. As I expressed to him, you know, there's a possibility we could extend some sort of credential or hire him on an independent basis, if it comes down to that, to go in our stead to these press conferences and file something for us. And see if the executive's office would still remove him. And if they do, then we have a serious situation on our hands. I might be coming to you guys to ask for support for legal counsel, but we're all getting ahead of ourselves. But hopefully they can work this out like adults. As you know, on the show, we've been talking a lot about vaccine mandates. I'm opposed to them in almost every instance, especially when it comes to first responders. You know, the idea to me that in the middle of a public safety crisis, we would fire police officers, that we would fire firefighters because they don't have a vaccine that doesn't stop them from spreading the virus, that doesn't make any sense to me. So particularly in King County, Washington, which again, Seattle is the biggest city in King County, so King County is very progressive. You have some agencies, fire agencies in King County, that fired unvaccinated firefighters when agencies just on the other side of the county border managed to keep theirs. But it sounds like there is a little bit of movement, a little bit of momentum in bringing some of those firefighters back on duty. I had an opportunity to speak with three firefighters from King County agencies who were impacted in various ways by the vaccine mandate. And now they're hearing that there might be, at least in two of their instances, some changes to their situation. Here's our conversation. Gentlemen, welcome to Undivided. I appreciate you being here. I want to go through and just sort of get a general introduction of each of you for our viewers. Ted, you are enjoying retirement, I imagine, but maybe a couple years earlier than you had planned. Give people kind of the cliff notes on your career and what happened.
I was 27 and a half years with the Valley Regional Fire Authority, most of that as a technical rescue specialist, and at least 10 years with FEMA. When the vaccine came up, I, for religious reasons, chose not to take it, on top of which I'd already had COVID, and natural immunity was pretty effective. Since then, they granted me a religious accommodation or excuse me, a religious exemption and no accommodation. So I was released on October 18th of last year and filed for retirement as of November 1st.
So obviously you were able to retire, but was there any negative consequence for you in retiring a little bit earlier than you had planned?
Well, I had planned to go 30 years. So it would have been another 2.5. The negatives are, you know, the additional pay in retirement that could have padded and made it a little easier, especially during the inflationary period we're seeing.
Gotcha. Carrie, same thing. Give people kind of a little brief on who you are and your career.
Carrie McCormick. I've got 16 years in the fire service. I currently work for Puget Sound. I'm a captain. I'm on a religious exemption with an accommodation to a training position, which I held prior to the mandate. That's about it.
So for you, you're still working. And has there been any realistic change, even though you're on an exemption and accommodation? It sounds like you're doing your old job.
I'm doing my old job. I have the inability currently to work operationally. I can't respond to calls, can't see patients, fires, things like that. And that's the biggest part of it for us. The change that we've heard is coming is the ability to go back to an operational readiness state, which we're waiting to hear what that looks like. Timeline looks like possibly November 1st, but until we see actual paperwork or emails or correspondence, we don't know that for sure. But that's my hope is November 1st.
And we'll get into all of that, but just for my edification, so you were in a training position before, but if you needed to be called out, you know, to the line or to a call, you could go, and whereas right now you cannot.
Correct.
Okay. Rocky, viewers will be familiar with you. We had you on. You talked about moving to Texas, but just catch people up who might not have seen our initial interview on your story.
Okay, so I am in Texas, currently living in Azle, Texas, which is west of Fort Worth. Still have not sold our house in North Bend due to the current housing market. So I am staying with a friend, a member who was also affected by the vaccine mandate, who's down here in Azle. Our family is living with his family. Currently testing for firefighter positions. But I am still not a firefighter.
Okay. Are you confident that something's going to pan out down there firefighter-wise?
I'm currently on two different lists, different rankings on those lists. One of them does not have a vacancy right now, so it's just an eligibility list. Another one, we haven't really heard any communication since the interviews. And then I have an interview on Monday for a third agency, and then doing a practical for a fourth agency tomorrow. So it's been a lot of testing for different departments. But so far, the earliest is probably January 1, if I make it through those processes.
And do any of those agencies in Texas require you to have a COVID-19 vaccine?
They do not.
Okay. So you three are interesting because you're kind of in a different state of affairs. Ted, you got a letter and a phone call. It's my understanding. What were the nature of those?
Our chief and then a deputy chief both called and told me that they would like to welcome those of us who had been released back to service. And then the follow-up was a letter that outlined the details of how that would look so that we would, our deadline to respond was today. I think all of us have done so in one fashion or another. I don't know what everybody's stance is, but we then responded and they would bring us back to training as of October 17th, I believe, with the intent to return us to the line on November 1.
So you responded deadline of today and you responded how?
I gave them a tentative yes, but I would like to sit because of the details that I would have to go through to unretire. I'd like to sit down with our chief and just go over some details about that, kind of the minutia and see how that's gonna work out and if it would be beneficial for me to come back. I'm kind of in a enviable position compared to the others. because I was eligible to retire. It wasn't on my timeline, but it still was a better option than being unemployed.
When, you know, and I, as I told you guys, you know, I've shared my opinion on this on the show, and I've been very clear about how I felt about vaccine mandates, particularly for first responders, for public safety reasons. And when I was saying that the state and agencies should offer people their jobs back, I heard from a lot of folks that they were saying, why would they take their jobs back? I mean, for you, after the way that things went down, why would you go back?
Well, for me, I really enjoyed the tech rescue disciplines. Obviously, as I stated earlier, I've been with the tech rescue team for approximately 26 of my 27 and a half years. I came in with a commercial diving background, so it was a natural fit for me to go right into those disciplines. And then the FEMA part of that was a good fit for me as well. Although I was a single dad at the time with two young kids, I wasn't able to go on most of the deployments, but still the training and the opportunities were there that were things that I really, you know, gravitated toward and felt good about doing and still enjoy doing.
Do you think you could go back free of animosity, or is there some anger there? Was there ever anger there?
I don't have any anger over these issues. I mean, it's easy to point fingers and armchair quarterback, but I don't know what kind of pressures that the chiefs were submitted to. I don't know what went on behind those closed doors. For me, like I said, I'm in a different position. So, you know, there was a little disappointment, but there's no animosity or anger, and certainly nothing lingering.
Carrie, as you kind of detailed earlier, it sounds like you think there's going to be an opportunity to go back to kind of full service, if you will. For you, did you expect that? I mean, what has been your expectation as you've been working on this sort of modified shift?
I believed from the get-go that this mandate would go away. I just didn't know when. I didn't think that there was enough chief to hold it. And, you know, it was all based on emergency powers, and you can't hold on to those forever. I was just hoping the timeline wasn't long. And I do feel that a year is about a year too long, but here we are, it's going away. So it's good news.
Has the change in your, you know, kind of responsibilities, has it had any negative consequences for you? Was it lower pay or anything like that?
I kept my pay. There was the loss that I took is monetary for the most part, and that's with the inability to accept operational overtime. But that also carries over to the guys on the street that are getting mandatory all the time. You know, there's a large increase in mandatories. There's still a lot of overtime. We're understaffed, and that's, you know, it goes back to it's not all because of the mandate. You know, we're always hiring. We're a large department. There's a lot of turnover, retirements. We hire as much as we can, but not everybody makes it through the academy. It takes a long time to get people to speed. There's a lot involved with it. That was the biggest hit, was the operational part of the being able to take overtime.
Where do you stand kind of mentally with it all? I've spoken to many firefighters, had many firefighters on the show, and it's kind of a range of, I mean, Ted, you seem pretty chill about it, go with the flow kind of guy. I've seen people very upset who lost their jobs, understandably so. So where are you at with things, Carrie?
I don't understand why certain decisions were made. But again, like Ted said, you know, I wasn't in those war rooms making decisions or trying to figure out what was the best thing. I don't know what data sets they use or continued to use. If they did at all, you know, I would assume they did. They're responsible people and with a lot to worry about. I'm angry. You know, I understand. I can take a lot myself, but the second that they walked into my house and took things away from my family, the ability for me to provide for them. I have two young, awesome kids. They took away the ability for me to provide at the level that I was. And that makes me more angry than anything else. Hopefully that goes away over time. I'm sure that it will. I'm pretty forgiving for the most part, but I don't forget everything. And the biggest hit was, you know, family. It's like hugging a porcupine now. I don't feelings are kind of just, my wife's amazing. Phenomenal, supportive, and I do feel bad for her, but I think that over time it'll it'll go away.
What do you mean? It's like hugging a porcupine.
You ever hugged a porcupine? It's probably not very comfortable.
I have not. Are you just alluding to your kind of emotional state over everything?
Yeah.
Okay.
I am.
Yeah. Rocky, for you to sit here and listen to these two gentlemen talking about how their agencies, which really aren't any different from your agency, are either changing course or about to change course, and you have not heard anything, how does that make you feel?
It's a little frustrating, but I think that as time progresses, that the Chiefs will find the right decision to make for their agencies. You know, if one King County department can do it, why can't the others? You know, there's nothing that is different other than borders and staffing levels. You know, previously, the fire chiefs have said that it was Dr. Ray who made his recommendation, and that was the reason, you know, and then it was pointed at the governor's mandate. And so obviously there's still some reason why the other agencies have not started bringing back their people, whether it's just they're working through the processes or not, but I believe they're ultimately going to bring back their people, or at least offer the jobs back.
But then what? I mean, last time you and I spoke, I mean, you were on your way to Texas. You were just moving out there, and you said that you would take your job back and commute. Do you still feel that way?
Yes, absolutely. Like Carrie said, you know, it's the people you work with aren't just coworkers. They're not just associates. They are your family. You live, eat with them, you know, the guys and gals at the stations. While that family was challenged during this whole ordeal, and the circle got a little bit smaller, still keep in touch with a lot of them. And, you know, in fact, one of my crewmates, if I would have stayed, contacted me just yesterday and just wanted to know how things were going. He's like, when he heard that other agencies were bringing their guys back, he's like, I can't wait till you come back because I'm ready to work for you. That's what makes it rewarding.
But for you, you've been one of the most outspoken people about this. You've been on the news. You've now been on with me twice. You've been very critical of the decision making and the fairness involved in it. Are you worried about how you'll be received if you go back?
I look at it this way. You know, I was a lieutenant. When the fire chiefs hire you and when they promote you, they expect very high accountability for you. Why can we not expect the same from the fire chiefs? You know, again, I'm not opposed to the decision making that they made if they can just, again, not violate constitutional rights, you know, not violate law. And I'm okay with that and I'll move on. But again, to date, most of them have not proven the undue hardship that they claim. And that's why I'm one of the few that will speak up, because as you know, I was in the military. When I took that oath, it never had an expiration date. So I'm going to continue.
And you were on a lawsuit, correct? Or is that still?
We initially filed a class action lawsuit last year. It was dismissed. The judge did not certify the class. And it made sense what the judge. So that lawsuit is no longer in play. As you know, we filed our tort claims forms with the department, which has been zero response as well. And there's no lawsuit currently.
So, gentlemen, I want to kind of end with the same question for all of you. You've been, like it or not, at the center of a lot of political debate. Talking heads like myself have talked a lot about the mandate and the people who are impacted by it. Ted, I guess, what would you want the public to know? You know, 27 plus years serving the public. What would you want people watching to know just about what it was like to kind of be at the center of this really odd ordeal?
You know, that it's hard to answer it for myself. Like it was mentioned earlier, you were talking, I was pretty chill. But, you know, I had some animosity initially because it wasn't just myself. And I think for me, because I was in that position, I watched my brothers and sisters who were in positions like Carrie and Rocky and young families. And my family was young as well, but I'm now an empty nester. So it was a completely different situation. And I understand their angst and their animosity. So, you know, it doesn't make sense. I'd like the public to know that there was no I don't believe that there was any real science backing it up. Now, I understand we didn't know early on. We didn't know. So, but the simple fact is, as firefighters, we were able to use our PPE and stay safe. I didn't contract COVID through my work or through coworkers or even patients. I got it from my kids coming home. So it was very mild for me. It didn't last even 3 full days. And I think that the mitigation things that we're using to mitigate it were effective. And so it doesn't make sense at this point, knowing what we know, not to let those people back if they choose to come back.
And actually, just one follow-up, just on the level of kind of, you know, animosity or whatever. Did it help that they called you, that they picked up the phone together and called you to offer you your job back?
Well, they didn't do it together. They did it separately. But the I've known both of these guys when they were firefighters. They were both junior to me. I helped them through their probationary periods. I've spent time fishing and hunting with one of them. So to me, I kind of cornered him on that and said, you know, it doesn't have to be a subordinate chief type of thing. Why didn't you just call as a friend to just see how I was doing? I think that kind of stumped him a little bit. He was worried that he might reveal something that he shouldn't. And I'm not going to probe him for that. That's, that wasn't what it was about for me. The real animosity I had was for my brothers that had a different situation than I did. You know, I talk about a lack of animosity because it hasn't hurt me the way that it's hurt others, because I had the ability to retire. So having said that, I totally understand where these other guys are coming from, and I feel for them, but it didn't hurt me in the same fashion.
Kerry, the same kind of question. You know, you are someone who has signed up to serve their community and to kind of be in this roller coaster. What do you want the public to know about what that's been like?
It hasn't been great. What the public should know is they have the ability to question things that they want to question. The truth doesn't mind being questioned. So have at it. The people that have the answers should be able to be questioned. And I'm sure they have answers, whether we want to hear it or not. Sometimes the questions are hard, but the answers are also hard to hear. I think that once people that actually care about the citizens get back on the street, and that's not saying that the guys that are already out there don't, because I think everybody that signed up for this job wants to serve the public and, the highest fashion they can. And that goes for myself. I'm just super excited to get out, and I want them to know that it's safe. We're okay. We're not out to hurt or harm anybody. And I'm just excited to go back and serve the people that ultimately pay me to do so. And I'm just excited to hopefully get back to that.
Rocky, we're going to end with you, kind of a different type of question, but since you're still out in limbo, what would your message be to the folks who have the power to change their minds still?
I think they need to look at all the available data that's out there and, you know, really communicate with their members. You know, this, I'll say that we always say the fire service is a family. So we need to treat family as such. Even if, like Kerry said, even if the truth hurts, tell it. Tell us why you made those decisions. Show us. And you may have those members that are vocally active. Go, okay, we understand where you came from. Not just kick us out the door and say, see you later, and never speak to us again. And that's where I understand why there are people that are angry, because they lost a lot of stuff. You know, health benefits, had to move families, you know, having to uproot their entire life and start over, whatever it was, you know. And I look at it from my perspective, I will survive. I've been through very hard things. I will continue moving forward. I feel bad for the junior guys who are just getting into the fire service, who all of a sudden got the job cut away from them, and now they have to try and start over again.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, thank you for taking the time. And thank you for obviously the work that you do for the community. And Rocky, I hope you can get back to it. Even if it's in Texas, that's fine. I'm sure it's nice down there. Anything else, gentlemen?
Randy, I just want to say again, thank you for sharing our story. You know, we really appreciate you always reaching out to us and wanting to know where we're at and continuing to share the story, you know. And hopefully we'll be meeting again soon where everyone is being brought back.
Yeah, I don't want to meet you, though, because I know you're a firefighter from my area. So I don't want to meet you out there.
Correct. Not in an emergency situation. Yes.
Yes, under good circumstances. So we will certainly keep updating you as things progress and as things change. I think bringing firefighters back is the right thing to do. It makes sense from a public safety standpoint. It makes sense fiscally when you consider how much money and time it takes to hire new firefighters who lack experience. When you look at overtime expenses. So I don't see any remaining arguments for keeping these firefighters off the job. And I want Rocky back from Texas. You can't have him, Texas. We need him back here. So again, we'll keep you updated on that. It's Friday. That means it's time to check in on what's happening in the Sunshine State. And of course, folks in Florida are still reeling from Hurricane Ian. So we'll bring in our Florida-based correspondent to tell us about what's going on.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Joining us is our Florida-based correspondent, my sister Miranda. Thanks for being here. How are things down in Florida?
Hi. Everything's going here in Florida. Obviously, we're still dealing with a huge mess on the west coast of Florida. A lot of destruction and rebuilding in the days to come, weeks and months to come, I'm sure.
Yeah, Hurricane Ian had me thinking a lot about kind of natural disasters. And, you know, obviously, hurricanes can be devastating, but the one benefit is that you know it's coming. And you can heed warnings, you can evacuate if it's necessary. And I was thinking about that because you're coming to see me in Washington State next week. Yeah. And we just had an earthquake in Oregon today. And I was like, I wonder if my sister would know what to do if we had a massive earthquake while she was visiting. So like, let's say you were here with me right now and there was a big earthquake, what would you do?
I would probably try to find cover under something or in a bathroom, but I really, honestly, my fight or flight instincts are not programmed for earthquakes, so I have no idea.
If you were with me right here, I've got this nice sturdy table, you would drop to your knees, you would cover your noggin, because it's very important, and then we would both just hold under the table. And we'd wait it out if it was happening right in this moment. But I will say this is a good opportunity for really everyone to think about what they would do in the event of a major earthquake. Coming up on October 20th is the Great Washington Shakeout. At 10:20 a.m. on October 20th, more than 1 million people across the state of Washington are going to participate in what is the largest earthquake drill in the world. And people are encouraged at that exact time to drop, cover, and hold on to practice what they would do in the event of an earthquake. It's also a great opportunity for you to discuss with your family or your loved ones other survival and preparedness tips, like having 2 weeks of supplies on hand in case of an earthquake or another emergency. You can find all of these tips at shakeout.org/Washington. And if you're participating, make sure to use the hashtag shakeout on social media. But at the very least, make sure you talk to your family and friends about what you would do in the event of an earthquake, and then join the Great Washington Shakeout at 10:20 a.m. local time on October 20th, where you will drop, cover, and hold along with millions of other people so that we are as prepared as we can be for a major earthquake. This message is brought to you by Washington's Emergency Management Division. So do you feel more comfortable now with what you would do if there is, God forbid, an earthquake next week? We'll hope there isn't.
Yeah. Well, it definitely helps to have some sort of direction, because if you're not familiar with an area's like natural disaster or even just their temperature and climate, you can put yourself in a really precarious position. So that's like, honestly, something I'm going to start thinking about when I'm traveling too. Like, are there volcanoes, or is there this area prone to earthquakes? Like, and just have some sort of prepared readiness in my mind for whatever may come for where my feet are planted at the moment. So yeah. I appreciate that knowledge.
You're welcome. Just trying to save your life, you know? Okay. Let's talk about the latest with Hurricane Ian. I wanted to just get your thoughts on, there was a few really nice moments between Biden and DeSantis this week, which is like, I hate that we have to celebrate it. Well, let me just play this clip for folks.
We were very fortunate to have good coordination with the White House and with FEMA.
What the governor's done is pretty remarkable so far. I mean, this is what he's done.
I hate that we have to celebrate or give them credit for being nice to each other in a natural disaster, but given today's political climate, I'm very happy that they could just focus on what really mattered.
Yeah, you know, I can't imagine that interaction going down any other way than just like, you know, united and, you know, offering, you know, support for each other. Cause like, I can't, like you said, like how else is this supposed to go down? I can't imagine him coming down and them bickering about something when there's so much destruction and devastation in front of them. It should be a very easy time to put politics aside and just get to problem solving, get on the same page and like offer support to each other. So it is really refreshing to see that they were able to have like a very like productive time together while Biden was here in Florida.
Yeah, I mean, it is the lowest common, like the lowest bar we expect from them. But with politics these days, like I'll take even the bare minimum of civility. So that was a good moment. You sent me a couple interesting articles I want to talk about today, kind of in the wake of Hurricane Ian. So there's a particular community in Florida, and they were kind of built for a storm like this. How did this, tell me about this community and how it fared in Hurricane Ian.
So this community is called Babcock Ranch. It is about 30 miles off the coast, which puts it in a place that is safe from most storm surges beyond complete apocalyptic style storm surges. This is also just I think it's about 15 miles northeast of Fort Myers. It's a small community. It's run almost entirely on solar power. They have about 800 acres of solar panels out there. The community also is surrounded by a bunch of like ponds and water reservoirs that can protect it from any sort of flooding, flash flooding, storm surges that do reach the community. All of their power lines are underground. This leaves them not susceptible to the high winds. And if you listen to some of these people that live in this community, like talking about the storm, like they felt the 100-mile-an-hour winds. They got the rain, but there, aside from the one stoplight just outside of the community that fell over, and then also a few street signs, they're like, you can barely even tell this storm happened in our community because this community was built to withstand a storm. I think it's pretty awesome. They even have roads that absorb extra rainwater. It's just like a really cool concept, and also kind of strange that this isn't something they take into consideration when they build any new community in Florida. But hopefully this is something that sets a precedent and people can see how successful this was. And maybe as developers move to continue to build more areas of the Everglades and South Florida, they take some of these things into consideration as they move forward in developing.
Yeah, and especially in communities that are going to have to be rebuilt after Ian. I'm sure there's some costs associated with this, but surely the federal government would offer some sort of tax breaks for this because it saves. I mean, you look how much money, taxpayer money from the federal government is being pouring into Florida for relief now. So the more damage you can prevent, really, that's a benefit for everyone.
Yeah, and each storm offers like not only devastation, but an opportunity to learn and to grow from it and set new standards of building. And that just should be something that should happen organically regardless. There should be no pushback against anything that was successful in this community being added and contributed to other communities as we move forward and growing the state.
One story I kind of had to laugh about a little bit. I don't want to laugh at anyone's misfortune at all. So just, you know, but California wants to ban gas vehicles and Washington State wants to do the same. And so when I saw this headline that there are electric vehicles catching fire in the aftermath of Hurricane Ian, I was like, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, that's a problem. And honestly, I think it's something that I can't believe we didn't hear more about before, because general knowledge of electricity is if it doesn't do good with water, you know? So if you have a car that gets waterlogged for whatever reason, whether it's a hurricane or intense amounts of rain, or you're just parked in the wrong place at the wrong time, your car is susceptible to explode and burst into flames, because that's what happens when corrosion and batteries get together. So down here in Florida, first responders are reporting a lot of incidents of exploding Teslas and other electric vehicles for this exact reason.
Yeah, it says Florida Chief Financial Officer Jimmy Petronis warned Thursday that as electric vehicle batteries corrode, fires begin, and firefighters have been called to a bunch of, quote, a ton of EVs currently disabled from the storm. So yeah, I don't wanna feel bad for people's misfortune, but this is something to consider. I mean, in all seriousness, I think there are a lot of issues with trying to do away with gas-powered vehicles when it comes to, you know, the electric vehicle technology and the cost effectiveness and all that stuff. So this is really interesting. Well, Miranda, as I said, you're gonna be here next week. And so I'm like, you might be here for our regular update, like in studio.
Which will be, I was actually thinking that too. I'm like, ooh, I get to do Florida Report from Washington. I mean, the Florida man will still be doing his thing. I'm sure Florida will give us all types of fun stuff to talk about, even if I'm not physically here. So it'll be a fun one for sure to be in your studio for the first time. I haven't been there yet, so I'm really excited.
Yeah, and I'll have to get you another chair. I promise I'll pull up another chair for you. All right, Miranda, good stuff today. Thank you.
Bye.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Okay, we're running a little short on time today. So for Understanding America, let's just do a quick one, shall we? Let's do a quickie. Patriotic music, please. The 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Very brief, very to the point. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. That, the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And that will do it for Undivided on this Friday. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your continuing commitment to give common sense a comeback. As I tell my sister there, she's going to be here next week. I'm so excited to see her. So we'll do a little Florida report in person. From Washington State. If you've not become a subscriber to Undivided already, there are two ways you can do that, and it's as little as $5 a month. So if you think that what we're doing is important, if you find value in it, if you appreciate what we're doing to hold elected leaders accountable and to look at things through the lens of common sense, I would appreciate it if you'd become a paid subscriber to the show. That's how we're funded. This is a people-powered podcast. And you can do it for just $5 a month at patreon.com/undivided. That's patreon.com/undivided. Or you can become a contributor on my locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. Undivided is presented by our founding sponsor, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com.